Welcome back to M&A Zing, the weekly podcast for acquisition entrepreneurs, holdco builders and search fund investors in the UK, Europe and beyond. I'm your host, Gareth Hawkins, co-founder and CEO of BizCrunch, fast becoming the end-to-end platform and AI-powered tool suite for small business succession M&A. Our guest this week is Robert Shaw, founder of Shaw Fox Partners, a search fund whose journey is anything but conventional. He's come from vaccine research at Harvard Medical School through biotech analysis on Wall Street, a senior director at AstraZeneca focusing on M&A and oncology, and then on to managing 50 million assets under management at a London family office, and now has arrived as an acquisition entrepreneur. At 45, Robert describes himself as a mid-career searcher at the tail end of a typical age distribution. I'd challenge that, being of equivalent age, sir. But with an MBA from Cambridge and a PhD in medicine from St. Andrews, he channels his experience in personalized medicine and biotechnology into his vehicle, Shaw Fox Partners, which is focused entirely on healthcare acquisitions. So today, we're going to explore how his scientific background has helped him navigate the search process, and we're going to hear his insights on AI in the search space and in medicine, and his advice about managing budgets and broken deals. Robert, welcome to M&A Zing.
Gareth, many thanks for having me and for the kind words. For a career that's been built on curiosity, it certainly has come out well on the other side of the wash, but here we are. So yeah, like I said, many thanks for having me on. Very happy to answer questions and guide, hopefully, anybody who's coming behind me.
That's very gentlemanly of you, and great, very much in the spirit of this podcast. We want this to be an inspiration for all searchers, either currently in the trenches or those that are considering this as a career path for them. So let's get into that curiosity that took you into this space. I think it's a great trait to have for any searcher, frankly, that open-mindedness and willing to step outside one's comfort zone. If you could, I've given a bit of a sort of brief Reader's Digest version of your career. I'm sure it felt a lot longer and more protracted than that, but give us the sort of blow by blow, if you don't mind, from your journey at Harvard through to where you are today.
Yeah, well, just to take a step back further to that, as you can tell from the accent, I'm Irish, and I grew up in 1980s Dublin, classic blue collar background. My dad was a painter and decorator, my mom's a housewife, and I suppose me and my five siblings, each and every one of us, boys and girls included, grew up on the building sites with my dad and just learning to trade. And maybe that's where the entrepreneurial bug was first bit us, in that you would see all sorts of wheelings and dealings, some legal, some not, but you would see a very pure and raw entrepreneurial spirit there in the building site. Fast forward to when I was 18, like most 18-year-olds, you don't really know what you want to do, but I did know that I enjoyed maths, physics, analytical processing. So engineering felt like a very natural fit for me at the time. I did my undergrad in engineering, Dublin City University, and then thereafter I went on to work for Ericsson, the telecommunications giant. Fast forward to 2930, and I thought at the time that the problems that we were solving weren't quite big enough, in that kind of naivety and almost delusional misplaced confidence that you would have at that age. But one problem that I did see, and I suppose at 30 years of age, you start to get a better handle on life, was in medicine. So my father at the time was very sick with terminal brain cancer, and it was that really, that introduction to very real world problems and illness, that I decided, okay, this is a problem that hasn't been solved. And because of my engineering background, we would work with large data sets. We would be querying them on the command line, that sort of thing. So it felt natural to move into bioinformatics, which is the querying of gigantic data sets, trying to understand what might cause a particular disease or a complex phenotype like that. So I did my master's in bioscience technology at 30, and then I went back and did a PhD to try and understand the actual molecular biology behind this big data that I was looking at on the screen. So that brought me to St. Andrews. I did my my PhD up at the School of Medicine there. And that was in neurodevelopmental disease and disorder. So it was fantastic. introduction to the biological sciences. And after that, I did my postdoc. So I went to Harvard for the postdoc. That was built on my research at St. Andrews. I wrote a lot of research there, published, and I had the fortune and the honor to confirm and name a human gene. So that was good. I made the step into Harvard. Then we did a lot of vaccine research, particularly in Zika virus. At the time, it was causing great alarm in the southern states of the US. So we got quite a large funding budget for that. And then fast forward to 2018. And because I started my PhD later in life, other things were outside of my work were coming to the fore. Do we want to start a family in the US? Do we want to move back this side of the water, etc.? And at the time, I could have moved into, as a scientist, into maybe pharmaceutical or continuing academia. But I realized that nobody wants to be a 50-year-old postdoc at the lab bench. I suppose in that I had reached... It's quite a flat structure. The academic sciences like that, you go on, you become a PI, you run your own lab, etc. But I figured at the time, in order to have those conversations, particularly if I was going to stay in Boston and bring me up to the next level, I needed to be able to understand the business of biotechnology. You turn a corner, every corner you turn in Boston, you bump into a postdoc, his professor, and a new startup. It's a place gushing with that entrepreneurial spirit. And I wanted to be on a level playing field with them. I wanted to understand business. And to be honest, at the time, as a scientist, I really didn't know the difference between a cash flow statement and a balance sheet, nor did I have to really. But moving back to towards this side of the water, I decided to move into equity research analyst position, which is a wonderful... Anybody coming out of the lab, any scientist who wants to get a handle on business, I wholeheartedly recommend moving to the sell side. So coming out of the lab, my natural specialty would have been in biotech. It would have been in gene editing, cell therapy, personalized medicine, that kind of thing. So I got to cover these public companies, write research on them, meet the CEOs, meet the buy side, meet the hedge funds. I was in the middle and I was learning all along how to understand a business, how to value it, how to forecast its TAMs, etc. So it was a wonderful baptism of fire. I learned a hell of a lot on the sell side. And then I moved to the buy side. Like you said, $50 million assets under management. I was a portfolio manager there. And you get to understand risk analysis. It's a slightly different skill set than what you have the sell side. It's risk analysis, it's portfolio construction, regulatory compliance, all those kind of things that you need to get a better handle of. So I did that before my move to AstraZeneca, where I was doing a lot of business development, competitive intelligence, M&A. Slightly different to the companies that we'll discuss today. But at the time I was doing my MBA as well, I felt that the return on my invested capital, i.e. my time, is a very poor one. And you'll find this in private equity, you'll find it on the buy side, and indeed you'll find it in big firm M&A. You could look at 100, 200 deals, you might pull the trigger on one. There's a lot of forecasting, a lot of legwork there, and I just felt that ROI, as you get older, your most precious asset is, of course, your time, and if you're getting a very poor ROI in that, then something needs to change. And like I said, I was doing my MBA, and we were introduced to the concept of the search fund. And at the time, I thought it was a very interesting intellectual curiosity. I put it back up on the shelf. I went back to my day job. But the more and more I ran up against these problems of, okay, this is a really poor ROI, the more I came back and took it off the shelf and said, what would this look like? What would a search fund for somebody like me, mid-career, look like, who specializes in healthcare? Am I backing myself into a cul-de-sac here? By not remaining agnostic, by not keeping that playing field as broad as possible and the universe of companies that I can be looking at. So come January of this year, I really started to look under all the rocks, to have as many informative interviews with as many people in the ecosystem as I possibly could. So that was everything from searchers to debt advisory to regulatory compliance to legal to anybody and everybody who picked up the phone to me. I must have had 150 calls over that time period, just trying to get a handle on, yeah, healthcare focused, traditional search ones, is it doable? And a lot of the feedback I got was absolutely, go for it. Your mid-career specialism really will help differentiate you from a lot of the younger 30-year-old MBA grads or non-MBA graduates out there who might spend 3 months trying to understand what a great sector looks like, what a great company within that sector looks like, et cetera, et cetera. And my knowledge of healthcare, not just as a scientist, but also in the corporate finance side of things, really led me to believe that this is a very defensive sector. Regardless of where we are in the broader macroeconomic cycle, people like investing in healthcare because fundamentally we all need it at some point, and it's not going to go away. So that brought me up to February, March, where I thought, okay, let's really go for this and start reaching out to investors. And that went very well. April, May, I'd say I wrapped up my fundraising very successfully. We were in the fortunate position of being oversubscribed. And I have, at the moment, a fantastic investor base, a great cap table that has a very mixed and, I would say, balanced expertise behind it. High net worth individuals, institutional funds of funds, family offices, some healthcare investors in there, some tax experts, etc. So we've got a great cap table, and I have a mandate starting from last month when I really kicked off the search. We have a mandate for 2 years to go out and find a great healthcare company.
Fabulous. What a great journey, and so much to unpack from that, Robert, if you'll permit me. So just something you said there about making the transition from the bench to financial analytics and corporate development, and how you would recommend that to any PhD who has been in the scientific research field. Could you elaborate on why that strong recommendation?
I think, so coming from the lab, it can be a very lonely venture that has certainly lent itself to what I'm doing right now. Coming from the lab, you are master of your own domain. You design your experiments with the help, hopefully, of your peers and your supervisor. But ultimately, it's up to you to really do the digging into the previous literature that's being produced on your particular biological question. So you're master of your own domain. You plan your own experiments. They fail. Why did they fail? Reiterate, refine, improve. So you're no stranger to be your own guiding light. And when you then move into, maybe if you're trying to take that next step in your career, maybe it's going to be into ETA, maybe not. Maybe it's going to be into broader finance. You usually land in a larger corporate development situation where you have HR, where you have, you know, strategic plan on how to develop you as a character and you and your CV, etc. So making that move, for me at least, I really lucked out in landing in equity research, because again, as an analyst, you perform your research, you value the company, and then you stick a buy, sell, or neutral on the front label, and then you go out, you meet the hedge funds, and you go out and meet the buy side and discuss it. And they challenge your thesis, just like scientists would challenge your thesis when you produce research. These other people are saying, well, I spotted a hole here. What you're thinking here, you need to produce a defensible thesis. So that really lent itself, I think, to what I'm doing right now. And then third of all, as a scientist, you're constantly living on the edge of ignorance. You're hoping that the next experiment is going to either refute or prove your thesis. And I'd like to think the searcher is in a similar position. You don't know where the next conversation is going to lead. You don't know where the next lead is going to, whether it's going to really open that door or not. And you really got to be comfortable with ambiguity and the unknown. You have to be comfortable in your own skin with having your nose pressed hard against the wall of ignorance.
I love that. So many great analogies. And as you say, those life skills learned in that walk, that being comfortable with uncertainty, that willingness to live on the edge of ignorance. I think it's so many useful traits and skills that come from that can be applied to search. Particularly, and I'm probably going to butcher this, but you know, I'd love to just have a little thought experiment on this. Having third parties peer review and challenge your thesis, is that something specifically that was forefront of your mind or in your mind influencing your decision between going the self-funded route and the traditional route, having a kind of panel of people that would, you know, hold your feet to the fire, if you will, in a similar vein?
I don't think it was a guiding principle, but it was certainly something that I was more than capable and comfortable with taking on, was that challenge from your peers, from your investors. Probably the more guiding principle of me going down the traditional as opposed to self-funded route was, I had, on the sell side and the buy side, I had been quite comfortable in valuing companies and looking at them and really understanding the business model and making them, what makes them tick, and forecasting growth, etc. But what I didn't have experience in was acquiring a small company. I'd helped acquire very large companies. I had valued very large companies. I was more than comfortable sitting in the C-suite with a $100 billion CEO, $100 billion market cap CEO. That wasn't the problem at all. The problem was, like I said, trying to acquire a small company that I'd never done before. I knew, and like I said to my investors when I was fundraising, I don't think I could have done this at 30 years of age, because at 30 I knew absolutely everything about everything. And maybe I didn't have that emotional intelligence that I do now, that comes with age, that you have emotional intelligence sufficient enough to put your hand up and say, I don't know what the hell I'm doing here. Can somebody please help me? And already I've really leaned into that in that cap table. And that's thanks to the traditional search firm structure, that I can lean into that and say, listen, I'm going to need some help here. How do you structure this? How do you reach out? How do you develop a sales team? Hopefully I haven't even begun to pester them with what I see as completely inane questions. But like I said, I'm more comfortable in my own skin now to say, this is where I need help. You know, that old adage, like, only the strong know when to ask for help. And
the purpose of traditional search is to encourage that, right? Is to have a panel of people that have walked this path, that are on your side to give you guidance where you need it. That's one of the real reasons why when we choose a traditional path route, we have quite a lot of comfort giving up equity, because we're giving it up to people that are actually going to help us achieve more than we could on our own.
Absolutely. I use that as a segue into the point about whether to go solo or whether to go partners in a traditional search. And I would be more than comfortable giving up equity. This was never about, and it never will be about, equity or that second home will come, that fancy car will always come. You'll always be able to make money in this world. But to enjoy that journey with somebody else, I would advise, and many people have come to me, graduates, etc., people are doing their MBAs, my own interns at the moment, who would reach out and say, should I go solo or partnered? And if there is somebody in your life that you've worked with previously that is also interested, that is also at that stage of their career, maybe an ops guy and a finance girl or whoever it is, that if you can bring that combination together, absolutely 110% go for it. Now, if you're in a position that you want to go partners, but you find yourself looking for that other person, that's a completely different kettle of fish, and it's not something I would recommend.
No, exactly. I think I'm seeing of the traditional search fund investors and in Europe a sort of preference for a joint searching team rather than solo, but they would perhaps even more prefer a competent, experienced, sector-relevant solo searcher over a cobbled-together team that have no shared history or you know, difficult to identify complementing skill sets. Just that hit by a bus scenario, contingency plan isn't really enough to justify one over the other. I think you're in a very unique position with your unique background and so well aligned and entrenched with your thesis that it's a bit of a no-brainer to back SureFox in that sense, because you've spent your career preparing for this moment, it would seem, perhaps not consciously, but it certainly feels apropos. So yes, very much the kind of antithesis of a startup-esque team coming out of LBS, combining their efforts to go and put their best foot forward, but having no real experience in the space. Can I just go back a little bit, something else you said around return on investment and how you reached a point where you were keen to make sure that your return on time, being your biggest investment, was significant. Could you quantify, I don't want to go basic and speak to Maslow's hierarchy of needs, but like, is it financial ROI? Is it intellectual ROI? Is it, self-actualization ROI? Okay, I did it.
It's a good question. And it's something that only really comes with experience and time. And how your requirements change as you grow older. I have a five-year-old son, and it is a little cliched and tried to say that things do change. Things do change the moment you see that other person who's reliant on you in so many ways, to guide them, to provide for them, to provide security for them, etc. But also to represent as a symbol of what they can do in their lives as well. A lot of people who go and do an MBA, whether they want to admit it or not, are primarily spending that 80 or 90 or 100 or whatever it is, thousand on a network. You will pick up skills. You will obviously pick up quantifiable and quantitative skills. Obviously, that goes without saying, but a lot of time you're acquiring a network. And when I did the MBA at Cambridge, it wasn't to acquire a network. I'd already had a sizable network at that stage, both in academia and in corporate finance, etc. But it was probably to test myself to see if I could do it. And as well as that, if I could formalize the learnings that I had acquired since leaving academia in corporate finance and just sort of formalize that. But also to represent to my son and to my children and to anybody coming behind me that, yeah, you can do this. You can make the move out of science, out of academia, into an MBA and beyond. It's there. It's all there in the ether for you to pick out, pluck out, and go. Just go for it. And so it's a long-winded way of answering your question, Gerard. It was an ROI on my time, but also just to demonstrate what could be done. And also on top of that, it was just to show to myself. As I touched on at the very, very start of the conversation, I started as an engineer. I moved into academia as a scientist. I came out the other side in corporate finance. And here I am, hopefully pursuing a path to CEO of running a company. And that takes adaptability. It takes, like we discussed, comfort in your own skin with ignorance. And it's that old Darwinism, truism of price doesn't go to the quickest, the fastest, the strongest, but to the most adaptable. And it particularly in this world of AI, if you don't anticipate having three different careers or teaching your kids that they can anticipate that, then you probably need to take restock. So you got to remain adaptable. And fortunately, so far, married with my curiosity, it's ended up quite well.
Great stuff. I think I found a kindred spirit here, a father of a five-year-old boy that's motivated by legacy and stepping outside of his comfort zone to achieve something great. And yes, I think it is a consequence of age, and we are motivated differently as we reach our mid-40s than we are in our mid-20s. And money isn't it, it's something more. And I totally support your thesis there. So on that topic, re-thesis, let's go into SureFox Partners' thesis around specifically acquiring in healthcare. Now, I'm trying not to bring my own ideology and prejudice as an angel investor to this, because I realize you're investing in businesses that are far more mature. But the maturity and sort of self-sufficiency existentially of these businesses in healthcare, it's always felt to me that there's this initial journey, cash burning journey in healthcare companies where they have to get to a point of validation. And then there's sort of the bit you hear about later where they've really made it and they've become, you know, huge corporations that have scaled up to, you know, serve, you know, a huge market and have, you know, either been acquired or whatever. The bit that we don't get to hear a lot about is that bit in the middle of a healthcare company that has made it, validated, reached a point of maturity, but still got a lot more to give. Am I right in thinking that that is the space or the stage that particularly appeals, or are you going later stage, and hence why you've chosen the traditional route where you're thinking, actually, I want like pre-IPO businesses here?
As somebody who's not just worked within academia and tried their best to understand basic translational science, to somebody who's moved to the sell side covering very, very early biotechs, which are essentially an idea with some IP stapled to the side of it and a lot of wishes and dreams layered on top, to somebody who's actively acquired public equities in large companies like J&J, Novartis, Big Pharma, etc. I'd like to think I can appreciate that wide range of company type, business model, and what makes them tick. So different companies at different stages of their growth phase and life cycle will exhibit attractive traits, let's say, and others not so attractive. So when you look at a very early biotech, I have to stop myself and slap myself on the wrist and say, no, Rob, that's not for you. It's very, very interesting at an intellectual level. The science is very curious, if not proven, but this isn't the hat that you're wearing today. The hat that you're wearing today is that you representing yourself and your investors is looking at free cash flow generative, tried and tested, proven companies that hopefully are part of a that have a strong tailwind, not just for that company, but also for the industry. So what does that look like? Healthcare is a very, very broad label. And naturally, questions that I house from brokers and investors alike is, okay, well, what subsectors are attractive? And of course, there's those classic criteria of the search fund where you want a fragmented customer base, low capex, etc.
Regular recurring revenue.
Yeah, but recurring revenue as well. But the great thing about healthcare is that it also introduces things like regulatory moats and compliance moats that are very, very difficult to get over. And once you have that as a moat, it's a very, very protective thing. Also, I'm looking for companies that perhaps their costs constitute a very, very, very low percentage of the overall product or service. You know, that classic trait, what was the book? The Outsiders, Bill Turndyke, represented some of the greatest companies led by the greatest CEOs were always those companies that produced a very, very small component, like the screws on a Boeing Airwing or whatever it is, the TransDimes of this world. So what I'm cognizant of the fact that I had to be very, very careful about the type of company that I'm looking at and not to go, because when I did make that transition, actually, when I made that transition from academia into the corporate finance world, I was very guilty of being completely enamored by the science. Looking at a gene therapy or a gene editing company and just being bowled over as a geneticist, looking at what is possible in curing genetic diseases. But unfortunately, that didn't translate into making it a good company. You know, the graveyard of biotech is littered with the bones of great ideas and great science.
Yeah, and of course, we're going through a bit of a paradigm shift now, again, more widely and generally in technology. But we can't be talking about the future of healthcare without talking about artificial intelligence and how that's going to be a big disruptor, but also a big catalyst for different subsets of that broad church. You're clearly a hugely intelligent chap. You must have thought, how can I either bring AI to this project post-acquisition, or what do I need to be aware of as AI headwinds and tailwinds in the market that I'm acquiring in? Could you speak a bit more to that?
Yeah, it's formed, I'd say, the third leg of the initial due diligence stool that I asked myself and my interns to pursue. The first is obviously, okay, recurring revenue. Is this a B2B company or B2C? And if it's B2C, how do we convert that into a more subscription or revenue recurring based model? The second is, where does the growth come from? It's well and good identifying a company now, but you don't want a melting ice cube of an industry that you'll very quickly find yourself stranded on. And the third is this, how AI proof is this company and industry? So as recently 4 years ago, or even less, there were people in the States who were acquiring electronic health record companies within the self-funded stable. And I mean, they were great success stories. Anything, the low-hanging fruit of this world, sorry, this sector, just like any other sector, is what can be automated, what is data rich that can be very quickly automated. Electronic health records is one. There's a few others that I've seen pop up in search funds in the past that just right now you wouldn't go near. Not because they're not great companies now, but because even in things like, for example, when you attend a physician in the US, they'll say, okay, they need an injection for this, they need it to be da-da-da-da-da. And everything is coded, from the bandage to the sterilized injection, you name it. Everything is coded. Coding is a great business,
right?
I beg your pardon?
For insurance and accounting purposes, largely.
100%, exactly. They were a great business. They are now dime a dozen. Those companies are being replaced by AI startups. Why? Because it's just a basic lookup. It's a basic lookup that just needs to be confirmed. And even in my old industry, an equity research analyst, like I said at the start, that it's a wonderful place to find yourself moving from academia if you want that introduction to corporate finance. But that's got to be under threat now as well. Why? Because you have data. You have big, big data that you can now crunch using LLMs, using AI tools, in order to get to a price for an equity that you can defend. So, like I said, it's the third leg of the stool that I look at. How AI proof is this industry? And to be honest, so far in my search, we're only a month in, but so far in my search, AI has most definitely been a help rather than a hindrance.
Yeah.
But it has shaped the type of company I'm looking at.
Useful to have some red lines that you can use for triaging and sort of thinning the herd. I think having these yardsticks to put up against your deals is very sensible. Just on the search experience, both the fundraise and the early sort of sourcing stage that you're going through now, just to analogize back to something earlier that you said about your kind of experience on the bench about sort of plan, fail, iterate as a cycle and as a resilience. How have you had to apply that? You know, what have the punches in the face been so far on this journey? I'm sure there'll be more. We all face them. It's rife. But could you speak to any and maybe some lessons for listeners?
Yeah, I'm a firm believer that success in this life is correlated with your ability to, excuse my language, get out a spoon and eat shit. And by that, I mean not so much working with or for jerks. You should never do that. It's being able to handle rejection again and again and again. Let's face it, there's no shortage in this world of very, very smart people. There's no shortage in this world of people who will outwork you, particularly with the dawn of AI, which has been a great leveling field for the hard workers in this world. But what would differentiate you from others is the ability to just take rejection on the chin and just go back at it again and again and again. And like I said, my background as a scientist certainly helped me plan that. I remember the first year of my PhD, it took me 8 months just to get the experiment to work. And any scientist listening to this will nod their head in agreement. Sometimes you need to get the assay before it even gives you positive or negative results just to get the experiment to work itself. That took me 8 months of just bashing my head every day, going into the lab for 12 hours a day, just trying to get it to work. So for me to be rejected by an investor, or my thesis to be rejected by an investor, okay, next, keep going, reiterate, do it better. And my advice to people reaching out thus far on how to fundraise was always, okay, it's a big universe out there of potential investors. What you should do is bucketize them into A, B, and C buckets and approach the C bucket first. Now, I'm not saying that they would be bad investors, they might be a bad fit for you. So, you know, I'd reach out to Brazilian investors, for example, knowing that it's probably unlikely, given we didn't have an existing relationship, that they were going to invest in me. But still, I get to cut my teeth. And the further you climb in your career, the closer you get to pure sales. And yeah, if you don't
see putting sales, the reps in. Putting yeah, the reps in. And actually, 100%. if you focus or hone your weapons, if you will, in that lower priority list, by the time you get to your category A's, you're on fire because you've done this, you know, 100 times by that point.
My daughter Faye came in when I was towards the end of the fundraise, and she could finish the anecdote for me. She said, "I've heard that anecdote before." it's not that it's scripted or anything like that, but you intrinsically feel where you've hit the mark, where you've ticked the box, what's landed, what hasn't landed. And yeah, you really, 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 by the time you get to the top tier or those who you really want on the cap table, you've made every mistake. Because let's face it, an expert, in my eyes at least, an expert in any sector is just that person who's made all the mistakes that are possible within that particular niche.
Was that not an Edison quote somewhere?
I don't know, but I'm happy to give it to Edison.
It wasn't something like, I didn't make 200 mistakes, so it was 200 experiments that proved that it wasn't the right way until I found what was, or something like that. Anyway, again, I've done no justice to a quote, but Google it. Last couple of questions, if you don't mind. What's your biggest challenge at the moment that you're facing? Obviously, you're a couple of months into the search phase now, the sourcing phase. So let's do with that first. And then if we fast forward 12 months, midway through your search phase that you're permitted, where would you like to be? What would you like to have achieved?
Yeah, I'd say the biggest problem, and I think it's a perennial whinge from most searchers, is just trying to improve your broker-led deal flow. You know, I did have, obviously, brokers from my previous experiences and my previous career, but like we said, we're involved in the SME space, the lower middle market space, which is a completely different beast and a completely different level of expectations and skills that you need there. So it's, at the moment, I'm working on building out my network, but in the brokers, and not just London, but also obviously across the UK and Ireland as well. And also tapping into the ecosystem that serves the LMM. So the accountants, the tax structures, the legal, etc. Anybody in that network that could facilitate an introduction I'm leaning into. So looking at healthcare, there's probably 5-6 brokers that are in that range that I'm looking at, from 10 to 50 million enterprise value. They really specialize on those healthcare deals. And it being a very attractive sector, not just to private equity, but also the public equities, there's no shortage of potential buyers there. So I try and address that broker that by improving my proprietary outreach. And how do I do that? I differentiate myself as best I can from private equity, from strategics, from alternative buyers. And I do that by really leaning into my background. I'm a scientist, corporate finance. I have a wide universe of companies that I'd like to acquire, but I'd like to acquire yours, and really just underline and double click why it's very, very important. The culture of the company, et cetera, is very important to just build upon what that seller or vendor has built. But also it really helps if you speak the language. So healthcare always made sense for me as a sector to pursue, because I just found it very, very easy to speak with potential sellers, because they like to see that somebody has done their work and can speak that language. And it wouldn't make sense for me to go into SaaS sector trying to acquire there, because I don't have the reps, I don't have the skill set there to differentiate me from the guy or the girl who's been doing it for 10 years.
Right. Great discipline and great strategy, Robert. And the question to, you know, the mid-search stage, how many deals would you like to have reviewed or killed or have under offer by then?
There's a very mixed commentary on whether you should be doing one LOI a month, or it's not quantity versus quality in many ways. I'd much rather be able to reach out to 100 highly qualified leads that I really know and understand the business very well, rather than 1,000 generic spray and pray mass campaign approach. But to answer your question, this time next year, most important thing for me would be to broaden my network that I could take anywhere, no matter what happens, improve my knowledge of various subsectors. And in terms of deal numbers, I mean, ideally, you read of search funds that have wrapped up within 3 months. Probably unlikely here, given the complexity of some of the subsectors within healthcare. But yeah, certainly, if the conversations I'm having at the moment with potential sellers keep bearing fruit, then absolutely, I'd like at least half a dozen LOIs in the next year.
Super. And I guess the mission for me is to reconnect and get you back on a pod at that 12-month stage and see if you still feel if it's quality over quantity. Because I think you speak to a searcher that's gone the full distance, and many of them will probably tell you that the discipline and the muscles that you exercise on the analysis side before you get to deal are completely different to the deal structuring, negotiation, due diligence that you do, and also the adaptability, to quote what you've said earlier in this podcast, that will come to the fore, I think, during that under offer stage, where you know the tectonic plates shift beneath you, and you have to keep adapting to catch up, because there are emotional, intellectual, market force, you know, commercial factors beyond your control, and sometimes beyond the control of the seller, that change the emotional attachment to the outcome of the process for them. And that can be a little bit frustrating, shall we say. So that plan, fail, iterate piece might come back to use even under that situation. It is woeful how many deals fall by the wayside, even when you think you're onto a sure thing.
Just to touch on that point, Gary, very, very quickly, I think the most important thing is to try and, because ultimately I think it's a numbers game at the start, is getting as many high quality leads to the top of that funnel as possible. Because let's face it, and you touched on it just there, luck is going to play a large part in the success of your venture, whether you like it or not. So for you to tip the scales statistically in your favor, you need to get as many high quality leads in the top of that funnel as possible. And then you adapt. And then you take off your investor hat or your broker hat, you replace it with your analyst hat. So just, yeah, be a man of many hats, be as adaptable as possible.
There speaks the wisdom and experience of years. Thanks, Robert. We are really excited to be tracking your progress and wish you the absolute best in getting the deal that you want over the line over the coming couple of years. So I think this has been an enlightening chat. To chart your career path to this moment, you know, just proves that there's no single path to becoming a searcher, and actually the path that you take will be much defined by your own experience, and that should inform your thesis. So great to hear how you've analogized the scientific research and the skills that you gained there in preparation for the corporate finance and M&A and acquisition entrepreneurship journey. So if listeners want to connect with you, obviously you've got shawfoxpartners.com. You're fairly active on LinkedIn, and we see you at lots of search events, but any other ways in which they should summon you?
No, LinkedIn is probably the most successful and easiest and most responsive. But also, Gareth, I'd just like to take the opportunity to say thank you for inviting me on, and thank you for all the excellent work you and the team there do in popularizing the ETA platform and getting out there and just spreading the good words, because already, and like I said, I'm only a month in, but already I've met several vendors who haven't come across SearchFront, who don't know what it's all about. And the more people that we can get out to and reach out to, the more fertile ground it is for all of us.
Very kind of you to say, and absolutely, we're all at the vanguard of this movement in Europe at the moment. You know, it's still early. It's not familiar to sellers or number of financiers or whatever. So, yeah, we have to work together to take that kind of burden of education on. But it's a pleasure and a joy, and it, you know, gives me the opportunity to speak to incredible people like yourself. So thank you again for joining us, proving that experience and passion is the watchwords, regardless of whether you're 25 or 45. It's there for the taking. So well done, and do keep in touch, listeners. Thanks very much for listening in today, and until next time, keep on crunching.